will, to accommodate a council scheduling problem, we'll depart from our normal course of starting with writs, with starting with a merits case, Taylor versus Commonwealth, Ms. Thomas, Ms. Adelphio. You may approach, Ms. Thomas. And would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
Okay, the clock will count down, and you're on your own for making sure you stop. I'll try to remind you if you start bleeding in.
But. Okay, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Megan Thomas, and I'm here representing Mr. Taylor on this appeal. As the court undoubtedly knows, this case was originally denied for being heard on brief. This court then reheard argument on that in November and has granted the petition in its entirety. The petition consists, or the appeal consists of four issues: a Miranda issue which is issue number one, a somewhat related issue as to whether or not a witness, Dr. Bernard Lewis, should have been allowed to testify, which is issue number two. Issue number three deals with the denial of a rape shield hearing, and issue number four deals with sufficiency of the evidence. I'd like to proceed, unless the court objects, with the one and two, see how far I get, and then into three and four.
However you wish, but of course, given what you've raised, that would also raise a fifth issue, which is any error being harmless or not, if there was error.
And the Commonwealth has pointed that out in their brief, and we addressed that issue in our reply. I would say for the record that we're incorporating all arguments that were made in both the original petition, the brief, and the reply brief. Jumping to the Miranda issue, I would argue to the court that Mr. Taylor was undoubtedly in custody on April 26, 2012, when he met with the detectives involving the rape of a juvenile named A.T. He was initially told by the police that he was being brought in for questioning concerning a missing persons case. That was not true. When he got the phone call from Detective Cho requesting that he come and speak with them, he was told time was of the essence and that he needed to come forthwith. When Mr. Taylor attempted, and I think this is critical for the later analysis, when Mr. Taylor attempted to assert control over that meeting by saying that he would come within half an hour or so when he had a ride, Detective Cho said, no, I'm going to send a car to come get you.
I hate to interrupt you, but
that's
you know,
okay.
Your time goes by so fast here. Let's assume for the sake of my question that we find that he was in custody. Why, given the various texts between David Petrilla and Christina and between appellant and David Petrilla, as well as AT's testimony at trial, why isn't all of that information and that evidence, which does come in, right? Why doesn't that make this harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, and I think that the short answer is because it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It is essentially a confession that the Commonwealth used and relied on extensively in their closing argument, but also to fill significant gaps in their case. Let's remember that this was a complaining witness who testified and admitted to being heavily under the influence of alcohol, such that she was not able to say with certainty who was on top of her, who was the person that she felt inside her body.
But conceptually, doesn't the case law leave open the possibility that even in a case of a confession, which clearly the jury would have given some weight to, the other evidence can still be so overwhelming that any error in admitting the confession can be harmless? I mean, conceptually, that's possible.
I think theoretically, that's possible. Okay. I would argue in this case
that's... Why not in this case?
Because she couldn't identify who her assailant was. She could not... She had been intoxicated pretty much the...
That was on direct, but then she backs off of it some.
On cross, she specifically says that she...
But doesn't Petrilla establish who was on top of her?
There are texts going back and forth between the two men, but there's certainly not...
The text from Petrilla to the other young lady.
To Christina.
The very explicit one.
Let's bear in mind that these were people who were no longer there, right? These were people who are sending these messages that occur or describing conduct that's allegedly occurring after they've left.
The one judge denial says that Petrilla sends the message when he returns. Is that incorrect?
Your Honor, I would defer. I did not try the case, so I'm going off of the factual record as I've
That's
gotten it in the
do,
transcripts. I recalled that the text messages occurred after he was gone, but perhaps Mr. Petrillo, one of them occurred when he came back. I can't say that for certainty up here right now. What I think is important is that the Commonwealth relied on lack of consent through the level of intoxication and through also the complaining witness saying at various points that she was, you know, mumbling no and was kind of smacking a hand away in order to really get at the crux of whether or not she consented and whether or not this behavior constituted rape. They had to rely on Mr. Taylor's statement. They had to. They didn't have independent evidence of consent and lack thereof with regard to the
defendant.
Didn't
they have independent evidence that would be sufficient to support to allow a jury to conclude she wasn't capable of consent?
I think that, Your Honor, she was...
testimony of no, and a hand being pushed away. I mean, that, both from just an intoxication standpoint and no, and a hand pushing something away, sounds an awful lot like a lack of a consent to me.
But, Your Honor, I think that in answering that, we have to look at what the evidence that the Commonwealth put on and the heavy weight that they gave the statement. And I'm reminded of this court's opinion in Zektaw, which also dealt with a rape case and a confession and whether or not there was harmless error. And the court was very clear in Zektaw that it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, obviously, when talking about constitutional error under Chapman. But
the Supreme Court opinion in Zektaw.
Yes. The Supreme Court opinion in Zektaw that specifically discusses constitutional error, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt error in the context of a confession, and that a jury listening and believing to a certain extent the Commonwealth's evidence, which we can assume to a certain extent they did because they convicted, the weight that they gave to that statement, we know because of the holes in the Commonwealth's case, must have been significant. And that can't be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Commonwealth, and in our reply brief, we address the various areas in which, in the transcript, they can find the Commonwealth relying on his statement in their closing argument.
Do you need there to be holes in the Commonwealth's case if, for instance, I would find that the evidence was sufficient to support a conviction, even minus the confession? Does that affect the harmless error analysis?
Well, I think those are two distinct analyses. One of them, you're talking about harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, constitutional error. The other one, you're talking about taking the evidence light most favorable to the Commonwealth and sufficiency of the evidence. And I think I think they're clearly distinct analyses that the court has to find, because the court obviously is undertaking a different analytical approach to both of those issues. On the issue of harmless error, the court can find that there was significant weight to make this statement not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but still find that there was sufficient evidence. I think that's entirely possible. That's what happened in the case of Commonwealth versus Mervyn Frazier, which was a case in an unpublished opinion by this court that also dealt with a sexual assault, a case that I litigated at trial and on appeal. And in that case, the court did find that there was not harmless error in admitting the statement, but also found that it was not proper to dismiss the charge, but rather reverse and remand because there was sufficient evidence.
So you're basically saying when it's a harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt analysis, that's a totally different analysis rather than an arithmetic formula or arithmetic exercise where you take out the confession and see if there's enough evidence left without it.
Yes. I would say those are different analyses.
So can I ask you this? Let's say you, like this case, you had a jury trial and you had the victim say in a rape matter, I saw him when he came in. I saw him when he attacked me. I saw him throughout the entire attack. I felt him inside me. I saw him when he left. It was horrible the whole time. And I, you know, no doubt. And then you have a confession that's suppressed. Can you have harmless error beyond reasonable doubt there?
I think you still can, absolutely, because the issue is whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The issue isn't whether there's sufficiency of the evidence. The issue is whether or not the jury gave such weight to that statement and the Commonwealth, or the prosecution in your case, relying on that statement so that it became a cornerstone of their case, I think takes it outside the realm of harmless error.
Is our inquiry whether the jury could have given it that weight, or is our inquiry whether we think they, in fact, did give it that weight?
Well, as a practical matter, I think the court is going to assess whether or not they did. And I think in this case, they did. The way the case was tried to the jury by the Commonwealth, the way the case was presented, relied extensively on his statement, period.
But if we are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that absent the confession, the jury still would have convicted, then the error is harmless, if we find error, it's harmless, correct? If we are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the confession did not impact the outcome.
I suppose if you believed that the confession did not, that it was harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt, that there's absolutely no way that this court can say that any portion of that verdict rested on the statement. And let's also keep in mind that we're talking about two counts that he was convicted of. I think the court, for harmless error to apply, I think the court has to be saying that no portion of that jury verdict could have been founded or was founded on that confession.
Or that aggravated sexual battery.
Yes. And I don't see how the court can find that. If we look at what the Commonwealth argued, the jury heard evidence that supports this element from Brent Taylor himself. The prosecutor told the jury she had played the whole recording of Brent Taylor's statement so they could judge for themselves. The prosecutor directed the jury to the statements that appellant made that she was passed out.
On whether there was error to begin with, the Commonwealth, without conceding the point, suggests on brief that perhaps at some point during the interview it became custodial. Obviously you think it was custodial from the beginning. Are there any other...
Are there points I think it's really
marks?
Custodial?
Yes.
Okay. There are points I think are really custodial. I think it is custodial, and I've got 35 seconds based on my math here, but I would say it's custodial from the get-go, and I've gone into that in the brief. Specifically, there are points at which Mr. Taylor says specifically that, can I go home now? That's the joint appendix, page 325. He asked Detective Cho. Detective Cho says, oh, just got some more questions. Do you know Detective Nemirov? Brings Detective Nemirov eventually back in. Mr. Taylor is saying, but why? You have all this information. I can't be in here any longer. I would argue to the court that those statements, when we're really talking about around the joint appendix, around 320, 324 on, where he is saying repeatedly that he wants to go home. I want to go home. He says it point blank. And they say, we're not quite done with you yet. We just have a few more questions. We'll let you know when we're done. How does any reasonable person believe at that point in time that their liberty is not being restrained to a portion, to an extent consistent with an arrest? I think, Your Honors, if it's okay, I will reserve the rest of my time. But I think
we may give you an extra 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Adelphia.
May it please the court, good morning. Catherine Adelphio on behalf of the Commonwealth. Even assuming that any statement Taylor made after he asked to go home was inadmissible, the admission of that testimony or those confessions was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. His confession after he asked to go home was not critical to the prosecution's case. It was cumulative. It was corroborated by other evidence in the record, and the prosecution had a very strong case without it.
How is it completely cumulative, Ms. Adelphia, if, for example, in the aggravated sexual battery? I mean, she does testify that she feels him inside her vagina.
Sure.
But he testifies extensively in his confession. He's in his confession to the police after denying it a number of times. He says, well, I felt her up. And he talks about all the parts of her body that he touched. So if all she says in her testimony is, and that's a pretty big thing, but and then she seems to back off of that in cross-examination, that she's not even sure that it was he, how is that harmless? How can we say a jury didn't rely on the confession and it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Taylor admitted to touching her breasts prior to ever asking to go home. So, and that was at appendix page 313 through 315. And so certainly that was sufficient. And I would say before he asked to go home, there is no evidence that he's in custody, or there's not sufficient evidence that he's in custody.
What was the, timing-wise, the statement of touching the breast, where was that in relationship to the service of the search warrant?
That was prior to the service of the search warrant.
Because the trial court seems to rely on Detective Cho's statement that he was free to do whatever he wanted at any time, Mr. Taylor was. But that's, I mean, we know that's not factually accurate, don't we? I mean, he didn't have an ability to refuse the search warrant, and that certainly, under the Harris factors, the sixth Harris factor of evincing a police officer's belief that you may be culpable for criminal activity, serving a search warrant and given what was particularly searched, would one feel free to leave at that, in that circumstance?
I would note, Your Honor, again, the statement regarding touching of the breast happened before the search warrant
but
was served.
The confirmation of intercourse comes after, correct?
That's correct. But there's other evidence of intercourse disregarding the defendant's statement.
On the argument that it's merely cumulative, if a trial judge, if there was an event that had two eyewitnesses to it and only two eyewitnesses, and a trial judge refused to allow the Commonwealth to call one of those eyewitnesses because, quote, it was merely cumulative, would the Commonwealth have a problem with that?
I think, Your Honor, the Commonwealth is entitled to put on the evidence that it wishes to establish guilt.
Well, right. And so we have an event that has two, depending on when Mr. Petrallo shows back up, possibly three eyewitnesses. How is it cumulative to allow both of them to testify effectively, the confession being Mr. Taylor's testimony? I mean, we normally wouldn't say she testified to X, therefore he can't testify, the other eyewitness can't testify to X as well. So I don't think it's cumulative, is it? It's another person confirming the event from a different perspective.
I guess the Lilly opinion, though, says that if there's other evidence, other strong evidence of guilt, then a confession is harmless. And in this case, the Commonwealth, well, the confession certainly helps the Commonwealth's case, but the Commonwealth's case is not dispositive on the confession.
You have. Ask you on that the sort of same question I asked Ms. Thomas. If we're dealing here with constitutional harmless error, of course, isn't that more than just an arithmetic exercise of, okay, we take out everything that's supposed to be suppressed, assuming we think it was custodial interrogation, and see if there's enough left in our mind that a conviction could occur? Isn't that more of a sufficiency analysis and not and a harmless error analysis involving constitutional harmless error, where it's got to be beyond a reasonable doubt? We don't know what the jury, how much they relied on the.
But, Your Honor, I would just note that the Commonwealth pointed out over and over again, and in rebuttal, after the defense made their argument, she returned to the text messages, and she returned to the victim's friend's statements regarding the intoxication level of the victim, and this other evidence is certainly sufficient to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And if I could briefly also point out, and this was pointed to by the Commonwealth, he lies over and over again and prior to asking to go home about what happens. He tells this ridiculous story about how he went home with Petrilla. He makes up this statement that, I yelled at her, hey, are you okay? And she responded, yes. And then, but we know that that's false because the victim's friend said he had to carry her up the stairs.
But Ms. Adelphio, you agree with appellant, do you not, that just even if we subtract out the confession and say we would have found that the evidence is sufficient, that's not the end of the harmless error analysis?
Well, it has to be sufficient beyond a reasonable doubt.
There is another element. In a case with two eyewitnesses, and you introduce the confession of one of them, I mean, how would that not have played a role in the jury's determination? I mean, is there any way you can imagine that the jury didn't take the confession into account?
I think that we have plenty of cases where the confession is held to be not a deciding factor in the harmless error analysis.
And that leads to the next question. It's inconceivable that they didn't consider it, but we're trying to figure out what they would have done if it hadn't been there, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would just point out again, the victim's testimony was unequivocal that someone raped her. There was the text messages between the defendant and his friend where they are discussing the fact that he's not having any luck with her sexually, and the friend suggests keep on feeding her liquor. And the defendant is clearly frustrated that he's not succeeding in his romantic efforts with the victim.
Is there any point in the chain that the Commonwealth is actually willing to concede that he was in custody?
Your Honor, I would suggest that no. But there is perhaps a point where it becomes more questionable. But in the ultimate analysis, the Commonwealth's position is that he was not in custody.
How about when the search warrant was served? Was he allowed to leave? Could he refuse the search warrant? He doesn't have freedom of movement at that point, does he?
No, but he had voluntarily come to the station. He never attempted to leave. And in fact, after he voiced this desire to leave, the officer says, "Can I ask you a couple more questions?" And he says, "Sure."
Well, I listen to the tape, and he does say, "Sure, okay," but it's like, "Sure, okay." It's like he's resigned. I'm not leaving here. So, and he's already asked several times to leave. He says, "I've got to get out of here," and he's just a few more questions for you. And this is right after, or very soon after, they did the swab not only of his mouth, which he couldn't refuse, but the swab of his penis.
Your Honor, I would note that this is a defendant who had a lot of knowledge of the criminal justice system. In fact, he tells the officer, "You didn't need a search warrant. If I had consented, and I would have, I could not complain that you used my DNA evidence against
me." Well, right, and that's an interesting how this might have played out differently, but once they serve him with the warrant, he is not free to leave, and he is not free to refuse. Isn't that correct as a matter of law?
Validly executed.
There's no challenge that the search warrant wasn't valid. It was validly executed. He has to comply at that point, doesn't he?
He has to comply with the search warrant, but he does not have to stay in the room, Your Honor.
Well, he has to stay there until they're finished.
And then they finish, and he could have attempted to leave after.
You don't think that colors the nature of the encounter?
I think that in this case where he said, "I'll continue to answer questions," and they never explicitly said, "No, you may not leave," that those factors weigh against the service of the execution of the search warrant.
Can you talk a little bit about Zektal, the Supreme Court's decision in Zektal, and the analysis, harmless error analysis that was the court went through there with regard not only to guilt, but even the sentence?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I'm drawing a blank right now on Zektal.
That was Supreme Court opinion from 2009, I believe it was 2008, 2009, in which the court talked about a constitutional harmless error analysis and basically found the other way, as I'll just say it like that, and even considered the question of the sentence in doing so.
Well, if it's a question of whether or not there is harmless error with respect to the sentence,
that guilt verdict and sentence actually.
Absolutely, I would note that doesn't affect the sentence and the guilt determinations of harmless error are separate, and so that.
Well, let's just focus on the guilt part then, because in Zektal, the court seemed to, it's not exactly the same as this situation, but it's rather similar, and they go the other direction.
But, Your Honor, we have cases like Alvarado also where they found no custody. They found that where there was no threats by the police, no indication that they were planning on arresting him, where they appealed to his interest in telling the truth, not in threats of prosecution, where he was able to go home at the end of the interview, where it was a short period of questioning. Those factors all factored into whether or not the defendant was or was not in custody. And so those issues,
I'm sorry, and that's separate from the harmless error analysis. But I just come back to return to the fact that he made a number of inculpatory statements prior to this indication that he desired to go home. And I think that the evidence in this case was strong enough that he was that you can say that the statements were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, his multiple lies, and if I'm remembering correctly, in Zektaj,
no question, his behavior throughout the whole thing is pretty horrible, and the lies can certainly be taken into consideration.
But the question becomes, are we in a position that the jury has found them to be lies because they were introduced, his own statement conceding that they were in fact lies?
But you have him changing his story
before,
prior to the issuance. If we think that the execution of the search warrant is the turning point, you have him changing his story prior to that.
He changed it several times. But of course, the major way, I think, is to follow up on Judge Russell's question, the major way he changes when he confesses. And if the confession is suppressed, assuming for sake of my question it's suppressed, it's just, I mean, if you had testimony, I'll ask you the question that in a way that I ask your opposing counsel. If you had a situation where the victim said, you know, I saw him through the whole horrible thing, and I saw him when he left. You know, her answer was, in that situation, perhaps it is harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, she says it's him, but then she backs off on cross-examination, says she's not sure.
But there's other evidence. There's other circumstantial evidence that it is him. He is the one who remains at the home. And I recognize that there wasn't semen or sperm found in her underpants, and they weren't the underpants that she was wearing at the time that she was raped. But he couldn't be excluded from her underwear.
Because the underwear was washed.
And she was wearing different underwear, but I'd suggest that he couldn't be excluded. David Petrilla.
Well, they didn't have enough on the underwear from the next day where they found the two Y chromosomes, did they, to really test it?
They had enough to...
to know that somebody other than him, another male was involved, had touched that underwear at some point.
Right, but they could not exclude him, and they knew that David Petrilla was excluded.
But the fact that they were two separate men would be enough to say...
And there was evidence there was testimony that touch, you know, just like whoever, that you could deposit DNA, like if you did the laundry, you could deposit that DNA. I'm sorry, and I want to move away from that because I don't think that is my strongest argument. There's no evidence that it was anyone other than the defendant who assaulted her.
There was no evidence, for example, that Ryan returned to the Heights, even though she'd invited him over to have a drink earlier that evening, right? He left.
That's
and there was no evidence he ever came back.
That's correct. And what we do have is the evidence that the defendant manipulated the situation such that he was the one who remained in the home with her, and then he lied about it four times at least.
Thank you.
And then only admitted that he stayed when he was confronted with the fact that other people said that he stayed.
Thank you, Ms. Adelphia.
Thank you. And thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your consideration.
Ms. Thomas, you have 2 minutes and 50 seconds remaining, even though the clock will run out at 2:20.
Okay, thank you. I want to make two very quick points. The Commonwealth argued in closing, no stranger came into the garage and did this. Brent Taylor did this. He told you that he did it. No stranger came into the garage. The reason she had to say that is because the complaining witness lied. She lied initially to the police. She lied initially at school. She lied initially to the police. She lied. That information was then conveyed to the sane examiner. She was a witness who was impeached. She was a witness who was contradicted herself. She was a witness who came up with explanations for her lies. But to get around those lies, the Commonwealth said, Brent Taylor told you he did it. There is simply no way to argue that it is beyond a reasonable doubt that those statements that they said, he told you he did it, so you know she was telling you the truth for part B but not part A, there's no way to say that played no role at all in the jury verdict.
Well, let me take you to your fourth assignment of error real quickly.
I'm sorry?
Your fourth assignment of error.
Yes.
On sufficiency.
Yes.
Even if we find that he was in custody, even if we find that it was error, even if we find that the confession should not have been admitted.
Right.
In conducting the sufficiency review, we are to consider the evidence, including the confession, mm-hmm. correct?
Correct.
Given that there is a confession, isn't the evidence at trial definitionally sufficient?
I would disagree respectfully, I would argue that it is possible to have evidence that is insufficient as a matter of law, which is what we're arguing, that there were too many inconsistencies, that there's an initial part of this statement where he denies any contact with her at all.
Giving the portions of the statement, the Commonwealth the benefit of the best inference from his confession, how could we ever say the evidence was insufficient given everything else?
Because you know that that statement was obtained in violation of his rights.
Right, but that's not how we do the review. You've just said we have to assume that the confession was properly admitted for the sufficiency portion of this. With the confession in, there's no way this isn't sufficient, is there?
You can still argue that statement, although admissible under this analysis only, I'm not conceding that, is not reliable. And that reliability issue, that in part gets to issue number two. But that statement still has reliability problems. Therefore, even if it's admissible and put in front of the jury, we can still argue that that statement was not admissible. That statement was not reliable. And I think that takes it out of that.
If you've got a confession, you only need slight corroborating evidence for sufficiency analysis, right?
And certainly that's true. But you have a witness who presented significant credibility problems. And the Commonwealth had these hurdles. And whether or not they got over them without or with the aid of the confession, I would argue to the court that's a very dicey position to take. And I will say that we do rely...
I'll ask you one final question.
I'm sorry.
Given that you're arguing that the confession was key
yes.
to the conviction and answered all of the jury's questions, if we do a sufficiency analysis with the confession, how can you possibly argue that the evidence wasn't sufficient since the confession is what answered all of the jury's questions?
Because I would also argue that statement... Again, these are two separate analyses, that statement is potentially unreliable, and that the...
But the jury didn't find it so is your first argument. Because if the jury found it unreliable, then it, of course, didn't play any role, and therefore it could be harmless error.
The jury could have both found it to have a part of their verdict, therefore it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but also still have issues with its reliability. And I think because those are two discrete analyses under Zektaw, and I think Zektaw is really important for this court, those inquiries have to be done separately. I don't know that our position is completely inconsistent, and I would ask the court to reverse the convictions.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Consistent with the court's traditions and merits arguments, we'll come down and greet counsel.
Thank you, Josh. Nice to meet you.